Mental Health Policy Committee to order as soon as we collect all of our members, so just take your time getting here. Now, Senator Telfer and I both had to walk up to our offices to get something that we forgot to bring.
And obviously you beat me.
Yes, yes. Okay, this morning we're going to hear what I think are model programs that we should be looking at to improve healthcare delivery systems in Oregon. Healthcare delivery systems are basically local. And a lot of the discussion has been on the big picture and setting up a superstructure to figure out all kinds of very complicated things, including benefits and who's going to be paying for them and so on and so forth. Senator Telfer and I met Senator Telfer at a conference in Portland when we discussed there. I think there were six similar programs, similar meaning that they're local consortiums of people coming together. I think 100% access. I was not aware of the other ones. 100% access, though, in Lane County, I think, has been very effective. And so we're going to hear two of them today. The 100% access and the program in Bend, which is the Health Matters of Central Oregon. So, would you like to get started? Susan Stearns, Director of 100% Access, would you like to come up? You can bring as many people as you want. Okay,
now,
good.
Is this Lane County?
They've started previously.
Okay.
For us to come up to you. Okay.
Now, if there are questions during the presentation, let's go ahead and ask them, because sometimes we forget what they are at the end, and so we'll just stop the action and ask the question, okay? Now, could you get the lights a little bit, please?
Chair Morrison, committee members, for the record, my name is Laura Brennan, and I work for Pacific Source Health Plan, an Oregon-based not-for-profit health plan that has been in business since 1933. Thanks so much for the opportunity to speak with you today.
Mm-hmm.
I'm the Community Development and Policy Director for Pacific Source Health Plans, as well as the Executive Director of the Pacific Source Charitable Foundation. Each of these roles allows me to assist communities throughout Oregon and pursue the vision of Pacific Source, helping people get the health care they need. I'm fortunate to be charged to do this work and provide support to communities and people regardless of insurance status. I also have the pleasure of working with community health collaboratives throughout the United States as a board member of Communities Joined in Action, a national nonprofit that provides technical assistance and support to communities around our nation in their effort to assure better health for all people at less cost. I'm going to start us off this morning by providing a general and somewhat 30,000-foot overview of community health collaboratives in Oregon and around the country, and then Susan and Mike will share with you the real deal, if you will. They are the true experts. There are hundreds and hundreds of community health collaboratives around the United States, including in Oregon, and although they vary in design and they vary with their initiatives and implementation and stages of development, they share two overarching goals. One, to achieve 100% access to timely, quality, and affordable services that are delivered by an effective and efficient, sustainable system. And two, to eliminate health disparities. There are approximately 1,000 communities in the United States who are reorganizing the way they deliver health and human services. These communities are bringing together public and private stakeholders. They're working in a collaborative fashion. And they're building systems that coordinate services and, again, assure better health for all people at less cost. And each of the community's stakeholders are acknowledging that they have to work together differently for the sake of their bottom line, the health of their workforce, and the health of their entire community.
Are those, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Even with my glasses, I can't read the... Are those significant, those different colored dots?
Chair and Senator Amanis Anderson, actually that map comes from about the year 2000 under the Bureau of Primary Health Care, and those dots, a lot of the programs are actually gone. I just stole it from the Bureau of Primary Health Care, the map.
Okay, so I don't need to worry about
that. I wouldn't.
Okay.
But the point is that those communities are just doing it. They're actually pushing up their sleeves and saying, we have to do business differently.
So just doing it is kind of the motto, right? Just
we're about action.
Yeah. Do it. Don't talk about it. Do it.
In Oregon, I have the honor to work with and serve community health collaboratives in 13 of our 36 counties, and each of these efforts are working to ensure access to needed and coordinated services in order to improve the health of the entire community.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Do you have a list of the areas that have collaboratives?
The next slide, I think, will help you, and if not, let me know.
Okay.
In Oregon, I have the good fortune to work with 100% access of Lane County, in Lane County, and Susan will tell you about that in just a moment, in Multnomah County, the Coalition of Community Health Clinics, in Klamath, Healthcare for Klamath, in Crook, Deschutes, and Jefferson County, Health Matters of Central Oregon, and Mike will share with you information about that in a moment. In Jackson and Josephine counties, we have the Jefferson Regional Health Alliance. In Baker, Union, and Wallowa counties, in the Northeast Oregon Network, or NEON, and then Project Access Now, Clackamas, Multnomah, and Washington counties in Oregon, as well as Clark County in the state of Washington.
So, Senator Ridger, your area is not covered?
I have none in my district, because I have Western Lane, so...
Mr. Chair, at some point in time, and maybe after this meeting, I'm interested... Obviously, in the Jefferson, I'd be interested to know what the relationship between that collaborative and JBH is. So,
I'd love to speak with you at some point about that, Senator Cruz.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you.
Absolutely. This slide represents how a successful community health collaborative positions itself. First and foremost, collaboratives are a neutral convener. It's absolutely essential. They must create a non-threatening environment for dialogue to take place. And this dialogue, it's worth noting, is very often among competitors and unlikely allies. In a safe environment, this dialogue leads to trust and action. Key tasks of the community health collaboratives include identifying the needs of a defined population, integrating and coordinating health and human services across organizations and across the community to address the identified needs, managing a population-based budget for the health and human services of the defined population, aligning financial payments so that population health outcomes are rewarded, and providing and contracting with high-value suppliers of primary and acute care, as well as other health and human services. Again, Susan and Mike are going to share with you some concrete examples in just a moment. Well, convener, coordinator, assessor, incubator, manager, all fine and well, but one may ask, and rightfully so, Laura, what the heck do community health collaborators really do? Well, when looking at successful collaborators throughout the United States, many begin their work with one, some, or all of what we refer to as the 8 critical activities. The 8 critical activities provide an opportunity for public and private stakeholders to explore working differently, to work together, to work collaboratively. Just examples, finding people who are eligible for publicly subsidized programs and enrolling them, making sure that those people are actually connected to evidence-based care, culturally and linguistically competent medical homes, affordable prescription drugs, and making sure that they have their chronic disease managed, and ultimately prevention and wellness programs to prevent those chronic disease from happening. When communities have success with and experience the critical activities, trust, confidence, and momentum builds. This momentum provides the platform for bolder, more comprehensive reorganization of a community's delivery system.
I'm sorry.
Absolutely. No.
It would be interesting if any of the collaboratives actually have performance measures that they say these are not only our goals, but how do we measure success, and at what point do we report the success that we have had in reaching our goal?
Senator Morris, members of the committee. I think that Mike and Susan will address that in a minute, and also with the Communities Joined in Action, the national board that I sit on that supports community health collaboratives around the country. That's a priority for us, and it was in 2008, and we're continuing that in 2009 to set common metrics and indicators and benchmarks for the community health collaboratives across the nation.
That helps to bring confidence to those people who contribute their time and money for the collaborative. I mean, it helps get community support if you can show them that, yeah, we're actually doing what we said we were going to do.
I couldn't agree more. Thank you, Senator Morrison. So the momentum provides a platform. Again, these eight critical activities, they're not the silver bullet, but they provide a platform for bolder and more comprehensive reorganization of a community's delivery system. And then the momentum and experience working together, again, unlikely stakeholders, competitors very often, we start building the basis for sustainable reform. We start working together, and we start working differently, and we start working collaboratively. The importance of working on promising opportunities, such as the critical activities, and experiencing short-term successes can't be stressed enough. And again, Susan and Mike will talk about that in a minute. Communities and stakeholders need to practice, if you will, in order for meaningful and sustainable reform to occur. So this slide, there's a list of the kinds of diverse public and private stakeholders that come together and join forces to build community health collaboratives. The point is, hospitals can't do it alone, physicians can't do it alone, healthcare safety net clinics can't do it alone, county commissioners or state legislators can't do it alone. We must work together if we're truly to reform delivery systems.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Where does the reimbursement people come in, insurers? Aren't they a part of it?
That's a really good point, and given the fact that I work for an insurer, shame on me, and that they're paying for me to be here. Absolutely. Thank you. Sorry, Ken.
Flip that slide.
I'll add that. They'll not make that mistake again. So a key step for the health collaboratives are really community needs assessments, and both Mike and Susan represent health collaboratives that have done truly stellar jobs of conducting needs assessments tailored to their unique communities. It's absolutely significant because it is very community-driven and specific, meaning that a needs assessment in Eugene is not necessarily going to look like one done in Coos Bay or Roseburg or Gresham or Bend or Portland. This is also an important point to emphasize because too many times state legislators are asked and tasked to come up with very broad-based policies to solve everything for every community, yet perhaps not totally understanding or able to address the unique needs of each community. So these local needs assessments really can help guide the work at the local level and hopefully policymakers.
Ms. Chair.
Senator Cruz.
I truly appreciate this. It drives to a point, Mr. Chair, you made last session in the 329 work group that this needs to be community-based, not top-down.
Yeah.
And also speaks to the work of House Bill 2009 potentially starting at the wrong place, moving in the wrong direction. Just thought I'd throw that out. But an additional question, because several times now you've talked about people that are competing in this system. I'm assuming we're talking about competing for their share of the pie, not access to patients. Would that be correct?
That's actually a really good point, Senator Cruz, members of the committee. I think that Susan might be able to touch on it. In Lane County, for example, you have two hospitals who, it's probably easier for me to say because I don't live in Lane County, but they were suing one another, and yet they would come to the table around 100% access, and they put that other stuff aside and the issues aside, say, okay, we're dealing with that. But when we're at this table, we have our eye on the ball. We share a common mission and a common vision, and that's better health for all people at less cost.
Now, what I want to add is DSIPA in your county and DOCS in Coos County, we should have invited them. Rhonda Busick is here from LIPA in Lane County, and she is part of the program. So this encompasses those two organizations. You know, that organization in each county should be an integral part of this.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I think that's really important in that particular area because we are a regional medical center.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
So I would think that this would be something that they would have probably already done. I'm surprised.
Well, maybe we can address to what extent have they been involved. That's a little sidetracked, but if you can cover that at some point.
Mr. Chair, I always want to know how these issues were addressed in the Oregon Health Fund Board review. Will that come? Okay, never mind. It'll come.
It sure will. Thank you for the question, Senator Montesanderson. So I'm going to move us to the next slide. And so once identifying needs, the communities do these needs assessments, and identify the challenges as well as the opportunities of the community that are in the community, the health collaborative and local stakeholders are much more willing and motivated to leverage and coordinate resources in their community. The collaborative as a neutral entity, and I can't stress the importance of the neutral entity piece enough, becomes a broker, if you will, of local and health and human services and creates financing strategies to assure better health for all people at less cost. Mike and Susan are going to give you concrete examples of that in just a minute. I'm winding my stuff up. One thing across the nation and across Oregon that community health collaboratives identify over and over again is the lack of coordination and communication among local providers of health and human services. A key role of the collaboratives is to break down the silos of care and entice organizations, that's medical providers, social service providers, public health, the business community, to work together. And lastly, through communication, coordination, and integration of health and human services, local delivery systems are reformed. They become significantly more effective, efficient, and sustainable. People have access to timely, quality, and affordable health services and human services, and these services promote the health of people and the entire community. So that's basically the overview and the 30,000-foot perspective. What you're about to hear from Susan and then Mike, the real experts, they're going to share the reality of community health collaboratives.
Senator Morissette and committee, thank you very much for having us. I am Susan Stearns. I'm director of 100% Access in Lane County. It's really an honor to be here today and exciting to see your interest in community health collaboratives. As Laura mentioned, 100% Access formed in the wake of the 2004 United Way of Lane County Needs Assessment. United Way does a biannual survey to really set the strategic plan for United Way. And the 2004 Needs Assessment showed that access to physicians, affordable medications, and affordable insurance were the top three needs across all socioeconomic brackets and both rural and urban Lane County. That really drew the attention of the United Way Board and other key leaders in our community, and that really started a conversation of how can we start to address this at a community level. And ultimately, what was found is that there was really a rallying cry that this could be addressed at the community level. There was really a pretty strong sentiment that the community leaders, both business, healthcare, human service, as well as government, had a shared responsibility for taking care of the uninsured. And really the rallying cry at the time and before Governor Kitzhaber started printing T-shirts, the line was, we can do better for the uninsured in Lane County. So that was really our starting point. I just tossed this slide in. Lane County has the second highest rate of uninsured. We predict that it's approximately 1 in 5 of our residents, and that's approximately 60,000 people. So we really have a pretty significant issue. I put this slide in really to show that we have an incredibly intentional definition when we say collaborate. Often people just use that term and really use it synonymously with, yeah, we've got to get together and have some meetings and everyone's got to be there. But truly what we're talking about, and just if you can look to the far right with the boxes, we are talking about how the organizations involved in 100% Access are ultimately changing how they do business and how they interact with each other. So the circle to the left is a big community meeting where we had a lot of people say, yes, we can do better. The center diagram is really our committee structure, with the blue in the center being our coalition, and that ultimately, as we are today implementing new programs and services and better coordinating across the healthcare and human service system, those organizations, those light blue boxes, are in fact redefining job descriptions within their organizations so that nurses who are discharging patients can do a more systematic job connecting those uninsured to a safety net clinic or to Head Start of Lane County or to a mental health organization. So we're really talking about systems change. We are not talking about building out a new safety net clinic or a new organization in Lane County. The early objectives of 100% access really were just, how do we start building trust and relationships across organizations that didn't talk to each other before? Laura mentioned our hospitals. In fact, when the United Way Needs Assessment came out, they were still involved in a very active and incredibly hostile lawsuit. The CEOs agreed to come to the table in the name of a community issue, namely how we take care of the uninsured. But at the same time, at a much smaller scale, our safety net clinics had never sat in a room together to even figure out how to share phone numbers so they could call each other. So when we talk about the delivery system, step one is, who are the players? Who's doing what? Can we better understand how we can coordinate existing programs and services better so ultimately we can really expand services and start filling gaps when programs don't meet all of the need? As Laura mentioned, the eight critical activities, our work plan, in fact, really were really the scope of those activities. We were trying to connect the safety net. We were trying to expand access to free and low-cost medications programs, connect people to chronic condition self-management programs, earlier mental health interventions. The list goes on. But truly, it was really, I think, a example of how the commitment to starting to do something locally and do something better in Lane County was so broad that we could activate committees around each of those eight critical activities. Some of our early accomplishments, and there was already a question about metrics. What's amazing to me is that, and of course, and rightly so, that the question should be asked, how are you counting your progress? What I've found in this work that continues to amaze me is that at a community level or at a state or federal level, we don't know what we're currently doing. So step one, again, has to be building the trust and relationships. But when our clinics first came together, we didn't know how many uninsured they were seeing as a community. We needed to build that trust and relationship, get those organizations in a room together so that we could actually look at what data they currently calculate and then start defining apples to apples how we can, in fact, get a sense of the total value that they serve and how many total uninsured, unduplicated patients they see. And we were able to do that. So we now know that they serve about 18,000 uninsured annually. That's approximately a third of our uninsured. That is extraordinary. We're very proud of that. And at the same time, it took us 6 months to a year to actually get that calculation. And you have to start from really building the relationships. Quickly, we've done a very comprehensive emergency department analysis. I'll show you some slides in a moment. We've developed a new voucher program. We can track those basic units of services. We are trying to take that work to the next level to really look at how the getting connected to a voucher program might keep someone out of the emergency department in the future, or how that might show an improved health outcome. We've got a lot of work to do there yet, and I don't want to claim that we've actually closed all of those loops.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Thank you. Who pays for the prescription assistance and medication voucher program?
The prescription assistance is actually free meds, which are available through the major pharmaceutical companies. There's different eligibility criteria. It does come with some paperwork, but it is indeed possible to get people onto up to a year of free meds, and that we have spent a lot of time really trying to build. We've got four or five staff in both major medical groups as well as safety net clinics that help people get onto prescription assistance programs, and we've been doing a lot of work to try to better coordinate that so we get people onto free and low-cost meds when they're not eligible for OHP or another medications benefit.
Follow up?
Yes.
And for reimbursement purposes, you use the formulary reimbursement to be reimbursed by the state
No, these are not OHP eligible.
None.
And so it has nothing to do with formulary or reimbursement. Here's just a sample of the emergency department data. I gave this presentation in November, and we really did, you know, a full hour of slides of our emergency department work. The point I want to make here is that, again, competing hospitals in the business place don't spontaneously share their entire data sets so that we can look at how many uninsured are being seen. What I'd like to point out with this slide, first of all, the orange line is the uninsured rate. It is, in fact, rising, but I want to point out too is that the uninsured or the OHP population also has relatively high utilization of the emergency department. So while 100% access is focusing on the uninsured because we really need to start somewhere, the data really allows many of our stakeholders to look at what the facts are so that everyone can start developing plans and strategies to try to keep people out of the emergency room and ultimately get them connected to systems of care and or clinics or medical groups earlier so that they're not using the most expensive point of care. The next slide here, again, and this is just an extraordinary slide, completely out of context, but the top line is alcohol use of the uninsured. And we can see that it's just dramatically higher. But the point I want to make here is that, again, we talk about with 100% access that access to care is health, mental health, dental, and social services. It is the complete network and system of care, and that we're finding that some of the most dramatic data coming out of our emergency department utilization is in fact mental health related or substance abuse related and isn't medical care at all. We're at the point now where we've actually developed little projects and had some successes around the eight critical activities, but truly what we're talking about is building that system of care for people who, the growing number of people who don't otherwise qualify for OHP or another commercial and or government-sponsored health insurance program. And our community solution to this is the Medical Access Program. And MAP really is starting to link together the discrete efforts of work, whether it's medications, chronic disease classes, safety net clinics, medical home assignment, and that MAP really is our baby little healthcare system in Lane County, and that it's not a rich benefit like OHP. It's a not an insurance product. It is not guaranteed almost anything, but it's our effort and our ability to better coordinate the various programs and services, health and human service, so that we can start getting people connected to what they're eligible for and have them stay on those programs and really be tied to more of a system of care. The uninsured, when they show up at the healthcare system, whether it's the ER, a doctor's office, or even a social service agency that might be screening for food stamps, the person starts over each and every time, and we're trying to better coordinate that at a community level. These are a couple of screenshots of a custom HIPAA-compliant website that we've developed.
Excuse me.
Oh.
Are you through with MAP?
This is MAP.
Okay, you're going to talk about the card.
I'm going to talk about the card, okay. I promise,
thank you,
Senator.
Thank you.
I know what you like.
Like the card.
This is our Medical Access Program website. We are, in fact, screening and enrolling people to get into this community benefit. They are first screened for OHP, so if someone can get onto a government benefit program, we're going to do that first. But what the screenshot shows is that we are, in fact, tracking the demographics of the entire family unit. So OHP looks at member for member, and that we know that some family members get on and some family members don't get on for a whole lot of reasons. What we are tracking, though, and this is a web-based system that is now available to all of our major health care facilities, both emergency departments, urgent care, the major medical groups, and soon to be our safety net clinic network, is that we are in fact tracking how the entire family is connected to the healthcare system. So we're saying if your kids and you're on OHP and you go to your school-based health centers, that data will show up on the system. If you are a single mom and you're pregnant and you get onto OHP, we're going to track that on the system. And if you're uninsured, you're an unmarried partner of the pregnant mom, and you need a care, and the only place you've accessed it in the last 5 years is the emergency department, we're going to get you hooked up with either a private physician's office or, in the future, a safety net clinic, and we're going to track you as an entire family unit so we know where you are, and we can start tracking the services and activity as you are touching both the healthcare and human service system. The next thing I want to show is that we are really starting to build a very basic activity, or when it grows up, it will be more of an electronic medical record of the patients who are being enrolled into the MAP program. So what is not possible today as if you're uninsured is no one knows if you've gone to the ER. No one knows what prescriptions you've been written over the last 6 or 12 months. No one knows if you actually went to the ER 3 months ago and actually had an x-ray, where that lives. So the activity log is the beginning ability to actually track that care and services. On the back end, as we have providers who are willing to see MAP patients, we are able to track the claims and services of the physicians who are, in fact, providing service, and that we're looking at how to collect that data so we can ultimately make better future recommendations on what services are needed for this growing number of people who don't qualify for OHP and other programs. And lastly, just for Senator Morissette, our MAP patients are, in fact, being issued a healthcare card. It's got a little puzzle piece logo. Our tagline is, we are piecing together the care that you need, and that, like I said, we are screening and enrolling for OHP first. There is an activity log of clients who are using this program. It's very limited. The number is still limited, but we're looking at scaling it right now. And ultimately, again, claims are being tracked by the healthcare system, just like OHP claims, and LIPA is our partner in that work. So just really to wrap up, and I get asked this question a lot, and especially with the level of interest from the Health Fund Board about community collaboratives. Why is it working in Lane County? Why is there such a great and broad level of collaboration across competing partner organizations in the healthcare market, but organizations that are working so beautifully together at in a community level? United Way of Lane County really is a strong has a strong degree of credibility as a convener in the community. They are not in the business of healthcare, and it was very easy to invite competing CEOs to the table in the name of a community project. I really give a lot of credit to Pacific Source Health Plans. We are incredibly fortunate to have a health plan that is so deeply committed to the community in our own community, and I'm fortunate really to work with the CEO and probably about half of the executive team who are all plugged in various committees of 100% access. I also credit the fact that LIPA is the single managed care plan to handle the OHP in our community. Ultimately, we know who's on, we know who's off, and that it just to have LIPA at the table and to be such a deep partner in our work means that we can just start filling the gaps as the community work gets defined. I mentioned just a final point, but really the goal at the beginning was just how do you build the trust and relationship. It was not fix the healthcare system. It was not figure out a program for 60,000 uninsured. We knew that we were going to start building the relationships and practice collaborating on a very small scale so that as we built some progress and momentum, we could start taking on bigger and bolder projects together as community partners.
Would you talk about the other organization that's there was a great article in yesterday's Oregonian, or Register Guard, I'm sorry, about volunteers in medical.
Sure. So just we've defined our healthcare safety net as broad as possible. We include volunteers in medicine, the school-based health center network, the community health centers of Lane County, which is our single federally qualified healthcare center, as well as the Whitebird Clinic, which has been around for over 30 years, providing medical, dental, and substance abuse care to extremely hard-to-serve homeless and chronically mentally ill. So when we say safety net, it's all hands on deck. We are also now just inviting mental health partners to the safety net clinic. So sometimes the most appropriate medical home is, in fact, a mental health organization who just needs a little bit of the ability to refer to a physician, but the true medical home could be a mental health organization. And that's we're looking at all resources and all partners in our efforts.
Thank you. I just distributed to the committee, this is a copy of a full-page ad on February 2nd from about the volunteers in medicine. Notice the provider list. providers who volunteer at the clinic. There are numerous specialty consultants, referrals, lab testing, and imaging. There are numerous people. On the back page, this was actually a full page ad, nurses, pharmacists, office staff, and other volunteers. Huge. Now, there is a crossover, obviously, between the groups. I forgot to invite Jackie Michelonis. I didn't think of that until I saw this. But anyway, beyond the grants that we have, this is this particular program, we have $1.7 million each year from the community. Our budget is $4.5 million, and that includes a lot of volunteer donations. We have $1.1 million worth of wholesale medications every year through the pharmaceutical and so on. I mean, it's an amazing program that they have in Lane County. And later in the program, we're going to hear from Kay Metzger, who's going to talk about the outreach program for seniors, which is equally spectacular. I think it's the only model of the state and the state that does that. So there are different levels that have come together, and I can remember going to some of the early meetings at Lane Community College where we would sit around tables and come up with ideas and so on, and it looked very, very chaotic, and it didn't look like it was ever going to go anywhere. No, really, and I went to a couple of those early meetings, and lo and behold, it... But I think the United Way, though, was very instrumental then in actually drawing it together. So you need some kind of a central organization, and it doesn't hurt if it's business people. You know, I mean, a lot of the business community. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, Mike?
Chair Morissette, committee members, for the record, my name is Mike Bonetto. I'm the board chair of Health Matters of Central Oregon and the director of Community Benefit Government Affairs for Cascade Healthcare Community in Bend, Oregon. I've had the pleasure of working with many of you for several years, so it's certainly nice to be back.
I remember all those evening meetings in 2003?
All too well. All too well.
It hurts to think.
So I do have a great appreciation for the work that all of you do at the state level, but I've also had the opportunity to work at the grassroots level for the last 4 years, and I think I really want to be able to share kind of that synergy of where we think we can have some better connection. I always find it ironic that when I was here working at the state level, there was always this kind of give and take with the federal government and really wanting more flexibility. And it's very similar when you start talking about at the local level and how you kind of have kind of state-driven policy that could be restricting kind of local innovation, and I want to be able to talk about that. The other thing I would say is that, you know, Laura here has really been driving this for, I don't even know, maybe a decade. And I think this is really kind of all coming into play for the first time. And I think if you would have talked about community health collaboratives 2 years ago, nobody would have known what you're talking about. And I think this is a tribute to a lot of her work that we're all kind of here today. So I'm going to get into health matters and really kind of talk about nuts and bolts of what we're doing in Central Oregon, but I also want to just kind of add on to what Laura talked about with an introduction. I think many times when we talk about a health collaborative, people really say, well, that sounds great, but truly, what the heck is it? I don't get it. I mean, a collaborative just sounds kind of different. And I guess when I was trying to think about it in my head, you know, I go and you look in the dictionary and it says, collaborate, you have to work together, especially in a joint intellectual effort. Okay, great. That sounds super. So now you get all these people together. And what do? You know, you sit around and give hugs all day. I mean, what are you trying to do with this? And I think it's you know, incumbent upon us to make sure that people really understand the collaborative movement and what it's all about. This I find interesting because the second definition says to cooperate with an enemy invader. Now that is something
I can relate to that.
Everybody can relate to that. And really, when you think about it, this is what we're all doing. Because you really, as Laura and Susan were saying, you have businesses that really understand they have unsustainable business models. And I don't care if you're a health plan or a hospital or a provider group or just a business. Everybody wants to do something differently. Everybody's very afraid of taking that step on their own. So you basically are creating this neutral convener, creating this safe environment for people to have that discussion around how they can do things differently. And that's really the emphasis of what we're trying to do. When you look at it, what we've done in Central Oregon, again, this was about over a four-year project now, but and certainly Senator Telfer has been there from the very beginning, a founding member, so she's been instrumental. we had a lot of discussion around what we wanted to be and who we were and where we were going. And a lot of it centered around access, but a lot of it, as you look at our mission statement, centered around health improvement. And that has been an ongoing theme for us, that yes, access is a means to that end, but not an end in of itself. And we're very, very focused on that really looking at the full array of health and human services. So as I mentioned, we started over 3 years ago. For me, it was probably 4 years ago, just on the back of a napkin of what things could actually look like. And then this started to come into place 3 years ago, just with a steering committee. Again, just kind of brainstorming of the right stakeholders and how we could do things differently. Now we do have this official board, 501c3 status, and really looking at driving change. And I think everybody's very, very committed to that. So we recently, along with 100% Access, were recipients of the state grant that came out of House Bill
3626,
thank you. Each for $250,000 for 2 years, and really trying to drive some initiatives that I'm going to speak about.
Excuse me. That is exactly the way I think our healthcare system should be built, is by a series of grants to communities to put together their own collaborative and then start building up, instead of having someone up there tell you what you're supposed to be doing. That is, so the grant program is wonderful, and I hope that we can continue it.
Well, Chair Morissette, thank you, and I think I'm going to add on to that, because I think you brought up some interesting pieces just on metrics, and I want to make sure that I touch on that as well. The other thing I think is really important for committee members to understand is that you're dealing with communities that have skin in the game. We're not really coming here and kind of asking for a handout. I mean, these are organizations that are contributing a significant amount of dollars. So with Health Matters, for example, all of the operations costs are covered by the board of directors. And again, I think I can get back to the point that it's in their best interest to be funding these initiatives instead of waiting and being reactive to anything. So it's not like we're asking the federal government or state government or anybody for additional money. We want to be proactive. We're certainly seeking significant grants from a number of foundations, and I think the big ask is, you know, how can we work better with the state government for more flexibility to do what we need to do? As I mentioned, Laura mentioned, the main emphasis has been on Crook, Deschutes, and Jefferson County. That makes up the Tri-County area in Central Oregon, and that's been our focus. So after a lot of discussion, and as Laura mentioned, the environmental assessment, we really landed on these two main areas: affordable access to services and coverage, and prevention and wellness. And within those two areas, we really landed on two key initiatives under each one. One is a coverage product for low-income, uninsured employees. The other, a medical home for children with special health care needs. I think what's important for us, too, to make sure that you understand, we're not here to reinvent the wheel. We've spent a lot of time talking with other communities. As Laura mentioned, you have over 1,000 communities who have been doing this for quite some time. We're really kind of taking best practices from around the nation, and that's been essential to us. So when you look at the coverage product, we're basing this off of Muskegon, Michigan, of all places. And they've had a program up and running for over 10 years now of covering the uninsured. You can think of it FEOP-like, but it's at the local level, so a lot more flexibility. So it's basically a portion of it paid by the employee, a portion by the employer, and the third paid by the community. And again, how those dollars come into the community, that is kind of that challenge. But grants and other things, they've been able to make that happen. So we're moving forward with that. We've got made a lot of progress, and we'll be launching that, I would imagine, within the next 12 months. Medical home for children with special health care needs. Again, this kind of gets to this care coordination. There's been a lot of discussion around what a medical home is, what encompasses that. And, again, we're taking this based off of best practice with the American Academy of Pediatrics. Prevention wellness, we'll be launching a region-wide employee wellness and consumerism program to small and medium-sized businesses. We've got several grants for that. And then a chronic disease management education program region-wide that is based on the Stanford Living Well program. And that has been coordinated with all three county health departments, and we've already started to launch that. So that has been a big win for us.
Mr. Chair?
Yes. Senator Morris Anderson.
You say you got several grants. Who do you go for?
who do you get most of your grants from, or can you
sure.
give a list
so,
of grants?
Sure. So we have partners right now. A part of our on our board, we have something called the Partnership to End Poverty. They've been significant partners with us from the very beginning. Northwest Health Foundation has been a big supporter, and we're also looking right now at a number of large state and with health and human or federal with Health and Human Services on medical home, and then we have some other big players in terms of Les Schwab and others with the employee wellness. So we're really trying to keep this broad based as much as possible. So, Chair Morissette, what I wanted to touch on was a bigger context. So if I was to back up and say the four initiatives that you see from Health Matters, I would say that really is just our first step. This is not the be-all, end-all of Health Matters. It was really kind of taking this initial environmental assessment, saying, what can we do differently? All right, these are the four initiatives we want to move forward on. The bigger context is really kind of what Susan had alluded to, is really how do you redesign and make a more efficient program for health and human services. This is really not just about, it is a portion of healthcare access, but there's a bigger piece of this. The picture that you see in front of you comes from some friends of ours in Richland County, Ohio. And this is from Doctors Mark and Sarah Redding, and they really have been instrumental in creating a completely different model than exists today. What I'm showing you here is what exists today. And what they did a fascinating analysis and looked at, okay, if you were to target an at-risk population, let's say low-income, vulnerable, pregnant women, how do state dollars and federal dollars flow through the system and actually touch this one individual? When they did their analysis, they found that there were 13 different funding streams that touched this one person and 7 different individual caseworkers. Nobody talking to each other. Nobody accountable for a metric or an end result. So you would ask yourself, again, you know, Chair Morissette, you're asking about metrics. I would kind of ask, what are the metrics we have today for the current programs that we have in place? So they saw this great opportunity to really change things and turn things upside down. And that's why I would certainly challenge many of us to think differently and say, it's really not about more money necessarily. It's really about doing it more efficiently. So what they've come up with, if you look at this diagram on the right, they've created this community health hub. And I think this is really a bigger vision for many of us now to see how we could do things differently. So they've restructured everything and now have the funding going to a centralized location. Once the funding is in a centralized location, now they can coordinate that care with a single individual. And what they've been able to do, let's say getting back to this at-risk pregnant woman, they've been able to take a community caseworker and have one contact. And that one contact is now paid on an incentive basis based on low birth weight. So you can actually tie that funding stream to the metric itself, which has really never been done before. So Richland County, I think, has made tremendous progress. You have the Ohio State Legislature that is very engaged. You have the federal government very engaged and really now supportive of this. So I think...
I'm sorry. The metric based on low birth weight... That's a measurable. I'm not smoking while pregnant.
Chair Morissette, what they have been able to do is set up a number of what they call pathways. Uh-huh. So they look at these at-risk. They look at these at-risk folks, and they have a number of metrics. Smoking could very well be one of them.
Well, let me tell you about our family. We had 11 children. We have 8 living children. 3 of them were premature. 3 of them died very early after birth. When we moved to Eugene, my wife was pregnant, and she went to a doctor, and he looked at her record and said, I'm not going to deal with you unless you quit smoking. She quit smoking. The next 2 children were normal weight, normal birth. The first one was normal weight, normal birth. The others were all premature. There is not a clearer indication of what happens during pregnancy if people smoke. I mean, that is living proof.
And Chair Morissette, I think you made a great point. But I think that the key thing with these types of initiatives is understanding what the end is. What is the metric? If it is a healthy baby, then what these groups do, they set up a pathway to make sure that that person has a care coordination system that is meets the full continuum. It could be housing, it could be transportation, it could be smoking cessation, all the way through, and access to medical care, so that the end result is a healthy baby. So smoking cessation would actually be a part of that.
Mr. Chair, your example, I want to use that for a minute because I think you just pointed out one of the major problems with the system. Because you look at a pregnant woman smoking as being a major issue, and I would agree that it can be. But the way the current system is set up, we will all come up with what we think are major issues, and we want to make sure that we're driving to dealing with that specific issue, and that's how we end up with all of these siloed funding streams and all of these accountability measures back to either the state or the federal government to account for these things that we have determined are critical and necessary. And I think where we're going here is the concept of the funding streams exist. The funding streams are designed to help people. Let's make sure the money gets to the community and actually trust the community to do the right thing with the money, rather than take up so much of our time with writing reports and having levels of accountability and having all of these agencies inside DHS that are tracking all of these things forward and backward. And, you know, a point you had made earlier is we need to start at this level, then work up. And I would suggest, Mr. Chair, that we start at this level and trust them and not create a bureaucracy up here to deal with something that we have blessed on this level.
Yeah, well, my concern with accountability is within the community. If they're going to
absolutely
get the support they need within their community, then they have to have the metrics or the accountability. Not so much for getting it helps, though, to get funding, but just and the trust level that we are doing something that works.
Okay. Chair Morissette and Vice Chair Cruz, I absolutely agree with that. And I think what the one thing that the I can probably speak for Susan as well, the one thing I think the collaborators would love to be able to see and work with the state on, what are the ends that you want as a state? What do you want the communities to be held accountable to? Then you can basically say, go innovate. And you know, here could be your block grant, but you're going to be held accountable to these metrics. And that's really what we want to be able to do. We want that flexibility to go achieve whatever ends we have. And I think that's one thing the state legislature may not always get to. And it's very difficult in terms of really defining what are the metrics, what are the ends that you want to achieve, and then you can, again, let those communities go and innovate. But that's certainly one of our goals.
Well, we discussed the block grants, and there were a few given, and that's where I think we should be going is, you know, we should look at what communities are doing, encourage them to get started, and let them fill out an application and go from there to support what the community is putting together.
Sure.
The example I give all the time is had Healthy Kids passed after the ballot initiative a year and a half ago, that DHS realistically doesn't have the ability to spontaneously enroll every kid and shouldn't actually be responsible alone to have to pull that whole thing off. But at the same time, I think what's exciting to me about that possibility or that challenge is that at the community level, we have the partnerships with the schools. We've got the partnerships with Head Start. We've got the partnerships with Relief Nursery and the other child care facilities. And the idea that we could, through the model and the collaboration of 100% access, work in partnership with our local DHS staff to run around and actually enroll every child, that's where the possibilities and I think the reality of how we ultimately pull this off really comes. And so I think that some of the goals like that and some of the make it happen, as long as it can work in the spirit of collaboration down at the community level, I think we're actually going to be able to pull this off together.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I have a question regarding this community hub. So you say all the funding goes to a community hub. I mean, tell me where that money is, say, in Ohio. I mean, who oversees that piece?
or where is it located?
Right now, they've been working on a pilot on demonstration projects. So they've really been working with the Department of Human Services. And what they've been on the pilot, so if you look at, again, this example, with they're taking certain populations, so whether it's at-risk pregnant women or some other group, and now they've been able to kind of take that money from a state level, cross agencies, and give it to this community hub, and now they're being held responsible for that end metric. So I wouldn't say that they have gone to a full scale with everything. What they are trying to do is take certain at-risk vulnerable populations and try that pilot.
Follow up. That still doesn't answer my question. I when you say the money is going to one hub, I'm still lost as to, is that hub located in the community then? And then who manages that? Who...
Chair Morissette, Senator Mona Sanderson, the hub is the collaborative. So whether it's Health Matters of Central Oregon or 100% Access, that is what we're kind of considering that hub. So they have their own entity in Richland County, Ohio, to do just that. So they've basically taken that concept of a hub, and that's their term for their collaborative.
And then follow up just... Because when I envision this, we get federal monies coming through, we get and so that usually comes through the state, and then the state then disperses. So I don't really see the difference between the system that exists now and this, because I don't think the feds, or do the feds feed you directly.
Chair Morissette, Senator Mona Sanderson, the feds do not feed us directly, but what they do is obviously they do fund certain agencies and certain departments, and that funding stream is very very diverse, and what they've been able to do is to streamline that. So yes, you're right, they are working with the state, but it is one point of contact, and in order to coordinate that, you do really have to have one point where all those funding sources are coming to. You want to add anything?
Chair Morissette and Senator Mona Sanderson, I have been working really closely with the federal government on adapting this model in 15 different communities around the country. And really, what happens, the sort of the nuts and bolts, is at the local level, a caseworker, case manager, community health worker, some entity, social service entity in a community, comes across, somebody walks through their doors, or they're doing outreach, and they come in contact, and the example we're giving right now is a high-risk pregnant woman. I mean, it could be just anybody who's eligible for a publicly subsidized program. So we come in contact with this person, and you immediately contact that hub, that community health collaborative. And it's HIPAA compliant, but you contact them and let them know that I have, you know, Sue Jones here, and they can identify immediately if Sue Jones is already on, is registered in the hub, if she's already receiving some kind of health and human services. So right there and then, instead of having multiple caseworkers, the hub says, okay, we have her already. Her caseworker is Laura Brennan, for example. And so we at the hub are making sure there's no duplication, and we're trying to really coordinate the services. How they're doing it in Richland, Ohio, as well as 14 other communities around the country, is they're paying differently. The hub and the Community Health Collaborative are contracting differently with the state government. The way the contract works is the first payment comes from actually identifying and enrolling a person who is eligible for a publicly subsidized program. So you find the person and you enroll that person. First payment, smallest payment. Second payment is you actually connect that person with evidence-based treatment. So if they need housing, a high-risk pregnant woman who's homeless, we probably need to get her in housing just as much as we need to get her to the prenatal visit. We probably need to get her clean and sober just as much as we need to get her to the prenatal visit. So when we connect her to evidence-based care, that social service agency, that hub gets their second payment for connecting that high-risk person to the evidence-based treatment. So that's the second payment. So first payment,
find them and enroll them. Second payment, actually connect them to evidence-based care. And then the third payment is having that healthy payment, that baby, and that's the largest payment. So really contracting differently, not just having somebody on a list and not just having that person get a letter or a phone call, but actually finding them, enrolling them, connecting them to care, and ultimately getting them healthy. So again, it's a three-pronged contract.
So
it's the same amount of dollars.
That's really clear, because from the slide, it looks like nothing's coming from the state, so to speak, but it really is, now that you explained it, that the state still has the money, but you're able to work, yeah.
And if
more
I could
collaboratively. Yes. I got
Thank
it.
You. If I could just add, the way we would talk about this in Lane County right now with 100% access is that through the collaboration, we are developing the more organized and comprehensive plan of how to connect the individual to a system of care, and that we are seeking partners and co-investors to help buy portions of that system of care. So I don't want you to think that the goal is for us to become the biggest bank account and to pool all of the money tied to Health and Human Services. We don't want to have all of that money, but the idea that we have the community-based plan across the partner organizations that can help make it happen, and the state will help sort of funnel money through or directly purchase a piece of the more systematic plan.
Thank you.
Chair Morissette, Senator Mona Sanderson, that's why Laura is truly the national expert. I would bring your attention to the Oregon Health Fund Board. And as there is so much discussion going on with House Bill 2009 and all the other health care reform efforts, I would kind of get back to some of their initial concepts of this building block four: stimulate system innovation and improvement that focuses on fostering innovation in the health care delivery in local communities. And I think many times we talk to this concept, but we don't really know what it means. And what we're trying to tell you today is this is what it means in terms of what we're trying to do. And you can kind of read the second piece in terms of really trying to drive innovation and what we're trying to get to a effective and sustainable system. So I guess, you know, again, from your perspective, the question is, well, what's the ask? And I think, you know, our response really is, how can we work with you differently to get that flexibility? You know, yes, the seed money for the House Bill 3626 was a great start. Again, we have contributed, we've raised a lot of community dollars just to get this going. But I think there's a lot more to be done, and I would certainly look to Senator Telfer on what she has done over the last, you know, 3.5 years with this group, and now looking at some legislation that would allow some of this flexibility to occur just on this coverage product alone. But I think this is certainly kind of some of the efforts that we're looking towards, certainly in 2009.
You want to talk about that?
Well, the coverage product, I think I've spoken with just about everybody here except for Senator Cruz, and I think we chatted briefly in the stairwell one day. And I'm happy because the good news about that is we're not asking for money in this piece of legislation. We're just asking for some flexibility in addressing supplying some health coverage to a geographical area of people who do not qualify for Oregon Health Plan. They are employed and they are working people, but they earn, you know, 300% the federal poverty level, but don't qualify for the Oregon Health Plan. And it's an affordable policy for them. And it's a multi-share where the employee's paying $49, the employer's paying $49, and the community's coming together for the other $49. But it's the flexibility that's needed. It's really not an insurance policy. It's a health coverage policy. It's not portable. You couldn't go to Portland and get the same thing because the community has come together and in an agreement said, we will service these people. And I think I passed out bullet points. I don't know that we're having a public hearing today on the piece of legislation.
I think that certainly is relevant to what we're talking about.
Very relevant.
And so will they have they will have a card of some kind to identify them? I mean,
we will get them a card, Bill.
No, but I mean, if you're...
We'll ask you to help design it.
No.
No, they would, yes, yeah. Because they would be covered by this product, therefore they would be an enrollee.
Is this your bill?
There's my bill.
Can I sign it?
You did.
Good.
You did.
I knew that. Anyway, no, but see, what these things do is it makes it easier to get grants from all levels, and then the feds pass through grants to certain projects that fit the criterion, and I think more and more, grant providers are going to be really concerned about what it is you're doing, and the evidence-based, program that you have and the accountability. So I think that's the only way to go. When you have tight money, you have to make the best of what you get and have the best evidence for it.
And if I may, Mr. Chair, the good news about this and all these programs that have been presented are it fits exactly with what the Oregon Health Board is asking for, grassroots community-based approaches to things. I think most of you, and if you haven't, I'll tell the story again, but we have a system that isn't working. And my favorite book, and if you haven't read it yet, I'll make sure, if you're riding a horse and it dies, get off.
Get off.
if you'd like a copy, let my office know. It's about systems that are broken, and this is a very creative grassroots approach to addressing the issue in a very effective and cost-effective also manner. So
that title has all kinds of implications for rural Oregon.
Chair Morissette, committee members, I would just wrap up by saying, is this the silver bullet, like a coverage product? And I think we would answer that as saying, no, we understand that. But it is this step forward of getting people working together differently. And I think that is absolutely essential. And what I found is so different from my days here of trying to have meetings with lobbyists and industry folks. It is completely different when you're having a meeting with all of the kind of same stakeholders in your own community. Mm-hmm. These folks go to Rotary together, they go to church together, they are neighbors. There are no R's and D's in this, I got to tell you. It is very much an independent movement that everybody's looking out for the better, the community good instead of kind of their own political party. And I think that really has something to be said for the long-term sustainability. So our take-homes, we are doing something locally. We really don't feel like we can wait. And I think, you have been here, I've been here for a long time, having these discussions about what we can do. The state has to keep pursuing kind of macro policies. I absolutely understand that. But at the same time, I think you have to be looking for vehicles of how do you implement, some of those larger pieces. And I think, we're really trying to get a foundation here of how do you actually implement that and start to drive change. And I would leave you with the more you could help drive and set the stage for those end results, those metrics, and whether that does come into the health authority or some other entity, that could really start to drive even more change at the local level. So, again, thank you very much.
Laura, have you been working with Douglas and Coos County, DSIPA, and DOCS?
Chair Morissette, when I worked for the state years ago, I did key informed interviews. I went around the state with another gentleman and asked the fully capitated health plans, specifically in rural Oregon, what they were doing and what was working to care for the Medicaid and as well as the uninsured. And that's when I first started sort of planting seeds about the community health collaborative movement, if you will. DOCS was at a recipient, and actually it was under the Area Health Education Centers in Coos and Curry County, a recipient of a federal government grant called Healthy Communities Access Program, if my memory serves me correctly, and they created a program called SCRIPS, Southern Coastal Rural Integrated Practice Team. I'm close, SCRIPS. And I, unfortunately, I think AHEC in Coos and Curry County has had some executive director changes quite a bit in the last few years, and so when I've reached out to them, I don't really have a good update, is in a nutshell. I've reached out, I have met with them, and we're talking probably 2001, 2002. I've reached out multiple times since then, but haven't heard an update. So
you will reach out again and report back to us, right?
I would love to reach out again and support them in any way that they deem appropriate and report back to you.
Good. Yes,
Mr. Chair. I want to thank you all for this report, and sometimes we tend to speak out of both sides of our mouth as a legislative assembly. You know, the building block number 4 is absolutely golden. We want local solutions to these problems, and at the same time, we are in the process potentially of creating this health authority in the state, and we're in the process of creating a health insurance exchange in the state, which is basically state control. And if I am in a community at this point in time, you know, how much of my skin do I want to put in the game with the very real possibility that the state's going to usurp anything I do? And speaking for my community, which gets very involved in very, very many things, we have a new cancer center being built in Douglas County right now, all funded by the community, entirely funded by the community. We have a lot of programs for at-risk youth, all funded by the community. I would submit that DSIPA and Mercy Hospital and the other partners in Douglas County, if they thought that they could create a system that they actually owned, would be more excited about doing it. But in conversation with my local folks, when they look at the potential that's in 2009, it gives them cause for concern. Now, is there a place for state involvement? Yes, there clearly is. But I think we have a tendency to think we need to have more involvement and more oversight and more regulation than is necessary. It does get back, and for those that have been around for a long time, we have chafed under the yoke of the federal government on so many different fronts, and because they require so many things that we think get in the way of us doing what we want to do. Well, I would submit, Mr. Chair, that we do the same thing to our communities. And this is the direction we need to be going. It needs to be a bottom-up approach to a new healthcare system. You know, hopefully at some point in time, this goes beyond just the uninsured and encompasses everyone. But I think the communities need to figure out how to make that happen rather than us telling them how to make that happen. You know, I would submit that what you folks are doing for uninsured kids is probably going to end up working better than what we would have given you. So, just as an example, and a conversation I've had for a long time here is, do we want an insurance product for kids or healthcare for kids? And I think this is where we're driving here. And so I'm excited about this. I hope that this concept and this approach doesn't get lost in the other things we are considering this session.
Good. Thank you. Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you. Kay Metzger. Well, this is exciting because, you know, you've made some improvements since the last time I heard of these programs, and so that's the exciting thing. And I guess the possibility of getting grants that go toward what you're doing, if you have a plan, increases the possibility, which leads into the next presentation of a federal grant that came to the state that was given to Lane County for a particular program. Very specific.
Yes.
Yeah. And otherwise you would not have received the grant. There were other applicants for that grant.
Correct. Yeah. Yes.
So would you introduce yourself, please?
Please. Yes. Thank you. Chair Morissette, members of the committee, my name is Kay Metzger. I am the Director of Senior and Disabled Services in Lane County. And I want to thank you for inviting me and my partner here, Linda Dreyer, to come and talk to you a little bit about our program and our services and the grant that we are now partnering with the Department of Human Services. But before I begin, I want to comment a little bit on the previous presentation and let you know that 100% Access has also worked on some services to seniors. really in the early days, prior to 2006, one of the committees was access to medications. And that was just at the time when we were planning for the implementation of Medicare Part D. And so some of our staff, in fact, the previous director was on a committee there and worked collaboratively with other partners in the community to really provide education and some comprehensive services to people in Lane County. And that was all part of the 100% access committee work, too. So I just wanted to say that we've worked with them also and very successfully. It's a good program there. Little introduction here about our services. Senior and Disabled Services is a division of Lane Council of Governments. We're what's called a transfer area agency on aging since 1984, actually. Previous to that, in 74, we became an area agency on aging when they were first mandated by the Congress. And in 1984, we opted to become a transfer area agency on aging, which means that we began doing Medicaid eligibility for seniors and people with disabilities. So in effect, what we are is a single entry point for seniors and people with disabilities. They can come to our office, and if they are Medicaid eligible, we do eligibility assessments and case management for them. But if they are not, there are also services that we receive funding through the Older Americans Act program and through the Oregon Project Independence to offer to folks that are not eligible for Medicaid. So we are a single entry point, and in that respect, we find it very beneficial, I guess, to be able to help people and direct them to the services that best meets their needs. As far as collaboration, this is collaboration from a little bit different point of view, with a little bit of a different twist, and that has to do with provision of long-term care services to seniors. We really have, as one of our core principles, partnering with others in the community at the local level to expand the services and leverage the services for people in Lane County. So in that respect, we work with the county organization and administration receive some funding from them to provide low-income energy assistance program eligibility. We also receive and have just begun to partner with our transit district, Lane Transit District, to do something new called transportation coordination, so that we are coming together with them, sometimes from different perspectives, but sitting at the table and working together to help coordinate the transportation options for seniors. And that actually is a position within our senior outreach program, or what we call Senior Connections Program. And I have that yellow booklet there. It's on, I apologize for not having the pages numbered, but it's about the third page in, where at the top it says just the facts, Older Americans Act programs. You're going to see the highlights from our most recently completed fiscal year and the numbers of folks that we serve through our Senior Connections program. And again, that is really focused on people that are not eligible for Medicaid, with the focus of helping them remain in their own home, connecting them with grassroots kinds of services within their community, whether it be volunteers or helping them figure out the most cost-efficient, privately paid individuals to help them with their care needs. What we've done, Chair Morris said, I did want to correct you a bit. The other area agencies on aging also do senior outreach services.
Yes.
Some of them contract with other agencies. We have taken the model of integrating it within our own agency, again, so that we're providing a whole continuum of service. Those that are not on Medicaid, really focusing on helping them stay in their own home off of Medicaid. But we can also help folks.
I guess what I was referring to is the Senior Connections.
Right.
Is that unique?
That what I wanted to say, Chair Morissette, was that the other area agencies on aging do receive funding to do senior outreach. So there are senior outreach activities. They do it a little. The other agencies on aging do it slightly different. All have at least a Oregon Project Independence case manager that goes out to help folks. But we have integrated that outreach effort within our agency. So we have folks that the design that we've chosen is actually to have staff outstationed in rural communities.
From Florence to Oak Ridge, from
Cottage
Grove to Junction City and all points in between.
Well, we have six offices, in those rural communities, that's where we are seeing that that person is the contact. They are the go-to person for those senior services, particularly in the Oak Ridge area, in Florence, Veneta and Junction City. We're seeing that they really are the hub of connecting folks in that rural community with services and helping them to stay in their own home.
Well, and a lot of the discussion that we've had with the Department of Senior and Disabled Services, James Taves, and so on, a single point of entry has been at the top, very high on the list of things to implement that a senior can call about. Any senior can call, whether or not they're Medicaid or if they're for pay and just need help.
Mm-hmm.
It is a single point of entry.
Yes, and so that's what we're trying to accomplish here with our Senior Connections program and really throughout all of our agency. Let me talk a little bit more about the partnerships that we have. As I mentioned, we are working with Lane Transit District, and also we have connections with our two hospitals that at which we have an outstationed Medicaid intake worker. So prior to the person being discharged, our staff person works with the patient to help them with a good discharge plan, help them to see if they can be eligible for any of the public assistance programs. And so we have good working relationships with our hospitals. And because of those partnerships that had already been laid and the foundation had already been laid, then when the state of Oregon began looking for partners for this Real Choices Systems Change Grant, they looked at several areas and felt that we were the best fit. So we had done, prior to getting the grant, we had actually done the work to lay, those relationships and establish those relationships. We've got more work to do. We're forging new relationships as we move forward with the grant. But it is exciting and I think a really positive way to implement services and move forward. You know, I found it interesting, again, the previous presentation, the phrase unsustainable business model was used, and I think as we look at the aging of our population, in fact, just sort of a sidetrack a little bit, but what we're seeing in our own agency within the last month is, or in the last 6 months actually, each month we're seeing 130 cases transferred to us, food stamp cases and some folks on Medicaid, from the self-sufficiency office. These folks are turning 60. That's the population we serve, people over 60 or somebody with a disability. But each month, 130 people that were previously served out of the self-sufficiency office are being transferred to our office now in the last 6 months. So we're seeing quite a growth in our caseload. And additionally, in the last 6 months, I just checked last week, we've seen about an increase of about 100 clients that need help with their care. We're serving 100 people more than we were 6 months ago with assistance with their care. So we are beginning to feel that impact of people aging. And I think as we evaluate these partnerships and even the value of programs, creative programs like the Senior Connections Program that work with people outside of the Medicaid program, we need to think about how we can use those funds creatively to keep people off of Medicaid.
I want you to, if you could talk a little bit about how you've used Project Independence funding. Now, Project Independence is zeroed out in our because the money that we, the fund that we draw from is out of money.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a senior deferral or house deferral program. But so the problem was that the co-chairs at one point thought that that meant that we didn't have to use general fund money anymore, and so if we don't use general fund money for the 0911 Project Independence will be one of the programs that may never come back. It may go away and it may never come back if we stop the program. So could you talk a little bit about
right.
how you're using Project right. Independence?
We use Project Independence funds essentially for in-home services at that at this point. There is a limit on what you can use those funds for. So what we found, and I think this is what you're asking, Chair Morissette, is we did a study, and last year we found that when we did a thorough screening process, you know, a skilled person over the phone talking to somebody about what program would best fit that person, and it was identified that it was probably the senior Medicaid in-home program. Out of, why, you know, 390, I think, folks, we had about 24 people that when our case manager actually went out to do the assessment and talk to them about their options, 24 people chose to go on Oregon Project Independence, receive a limited amount of in-home help. Our agency allows up to 20 hours of in-home help per month through the Oregon Project Independence, and that's it. Well, they can get some home-delivered meals, but there's no medical coverage with the Oregon Project Independence, and that's what makes it cost-effective. But 24 of those folks chose to go on Oregon Project Independence instead of going on Medicaid, and these were folks that at first blush it looked like they would be eligible for Medicaid. So we are seeing some folks, when given the opportunity, will choose Oregon Project Independence.
Well, now, the concern would be, why are we not using Medicaid match dollars to help these people?
Well, I think what is cost-effective about this program is that by not going on Medicaid, the state is not paying for their health insurance then, the Oregon Health Plan. So there's not that capitation payment or that piece of it. So Medicare is covering the medical costs for these folks, and then the state is paying a little bit of money. I think the average is around $250 a month for the in-home help that these folks receive. To be quite honest, I think if we were thinking creatively, I think it would be interesting to look at expanding the Oregon Project Independence so that there could be some kind of flexibility so that perhaps folks that are in care facilities, not nursing homes, but in care facilities that just needed, you know, some kind of cap, but a little bit of supplemental income to pay for their care and ultimately keep them off of Medicaid. I mean, that would be the goal, is that you then save the cost of covering their medical costs because they're already covered by Medicare and Medicare Part D. It might be a way to prevent folks, you know, the influx of people going on Medicaid.
Okay.
At a more
so
cost.
The big picture then is if we did fund Project Independence adequately. Now, are you the only county that is using that particular approach? But the big picture is that you could save expenditures on Medicaid. But would that help you? Do you get the extra money that you saved to use on another program or to use on Project Independence?
Chair Morris said, is your question, would it help my agency?
Well, we're saving some Medicaid dollars. Who
yes.
benefits from saving the Medicaid dollars?
Well, I would think this, Chair Morris said, I would think the state in general, that it would be more cost-effective. And what I was trying to point out was that with the influx of more people aging,
mm-hmm.
you can keep folks off of Medicaid for a longer period of time, ultimately you're going to save money.
Okay. Now, the people that you help with Project Independence money fit within the self-imposed cap that Project Independence does not have federal dollars, so they're...
Correct.
Yeah, okay. So the means test that you apply applies to these people, right? And do some of them pay part of their Project Independence?
Chair Morissette, the Oregon Project Independence does not have an assets test. However, participants do pay a
copay on a sliding scale fee according to their income. These folks that I referenced before, the 24, again, the phone screening, and it is the screening is done in our office by a case manager who talks to the person about their assets and what it means to be eligible for Medicaid. That person, that case manager, just from the phone screening, determined that that person was likely a potential Medicaid client. And so then we made an appointment and sent a case manager out to do a Medicaid appointment. That person chose then to go with OPI because, you know, it was a better program for them, or they opted to stay off of Medicaid for a while.
Good. Questions? Okay. Thank you.
Good.
I didn't mean to interrupt where you were. Are you...
Chair Morissette, I guess I would like to allow Linda Dreyer to talk a little bit about the grant that we're partnering with and excited about.
Yeah. Chair Morissette, members of the committee, my name is Linda Dreyer. I'm employed by Senior and People with Disabilities, and I'm the manager of the Real Choices Systems Change Grant. This is a three-year grant award of $1.6 million from the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services. Half of the grant funds are allocated to developing and implementing a prototype person-centered hospital discharge planning model. The target audience for this pilot are Medicaid consumers with chronic conditions or disabilities. And one goal is to help those consumers who wish to return to their own home or to a community-based care setting at discharge to do so successfully and thereby prevent some unnecessary nursing home placements. The other half of the grant funds are allocated to developing a prototype aging and disability resource center. The target population for this pilot are people of any income level who have a need for information about long-term care services and supports. At least one goal of this project is to enable these consumers to make informed and cost-effective decisions about their use of long-term care services and to be a one-stop shop for access to such services. Both prototypes are going to need to be able to be replicated statewide. There are about four major areas of work that are currently underway with this grant. First, we're getting the Lane County Care Transitions Task Force up and running. The task force includes members from Case Group, Lane Council of Governments, as well as Lane Independent Individual Practice Association, Lane Independent Living Alliance, and Sacred Heart Medical Center. This task force needs to begin the big work of developing the design requirements for the hospital discharge model. We are also completing a review of how consumers flow through each of the lead organization's current systems. Once that review is complete, we'll compare our findings with best practices that have been developed from other states and projects, as well as some work that was done by an ADRC steering committee that SBD launched in 2007-2008. I think once we have been able to do that comparison, we'll be able to identify some places where current systems need to be tweaked or perhaps some new processes need to be developed. Thirdly, we're waiting for some guidance from CMS to complete work on what our overall performance measures are going to be, and also to make sure that we have the data sources in place to be able to relate to those measures. And lastly, we're in the process of recruiting a statewide advisory council whose main task will be to advise SPD on how the ADRC can be replicated and implemented statewide. Thanks for the opportunity to give you this progress report, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
When I spoke to the president of the Senate about why I wanted to work on this project at this particular time when we don't have adequate funding, I said this is the time to bring the communities together, because they have to come together. This is the perfect time to build programs that will then be implemented in the future. And So and it adds to the urgency of what you're doing. You have to do it because the people are there, and you just and so I think the grant is great to help do this. But I think that's my philosophy right now, that we don't have a whole lot of money. I hope we get Project Independence refunded. I mean, that would be tragic to lose that. Mm-hmm. But it's a planning time, and we'll get things laid out so when good times come, we can start the funding programs even better. Rhonda Busick, would you come up?
Chair, may I,
Yes, Senator Berger.
May I just make a comment? The people in my district, and that's Western Lane over in the Florence area, I go as far as Elmira, but where I really hear about this is in the Florence area. They feel so disconnected somehow to the things that happen basically in Eugene and coming from the commission office and so forth. And I just want to lift that in front of you since you're from Lane County. I try to do that every time somebody crosses my path that is from Lane County. I think having a new commissioner from Florence has helped. Are you very active in these programs in Western Lane?
Chair Morissette, Senator Verger, yes, we are. I do have a senior connections coordinator out in the Florence area, and she's full-time there. She works with the folks out there. And additionally, through the grant, part of the planning is that out in the Florence area, we will be working towards having an ADRC specialist and a staff person stationed at the hospital to help with the person-centered discharge planning. So actually that is part of the planning for the grant. It will come towards the end of the grant period. And Linda, if you want to talk a little bit more about that, but yes, it is part of the grant.
Follow up. Chris Flemang does a wonderful job down in the southern part of my district, and of course Mr. John Helm we see here, the legislature, who is with the state board. So that's I have lots of contact, and just a wonderful program, but I just always like to express, don't forget Florence.
Okay.
All right.
Well, I think what she's saying is that you need to send her some information. I mean, she needs to have the information that...
And know a little bit more about what happens in Florence.
Yeah, and the contact person for senior connections, and so when she is, you know, asked about that, she has more information. But,
that would be good. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah. Rhonda Busick, would you introduce yourself, please, and tell us why you're here?
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. My name is Rhonda Busick, and I'm Chief Operations Officer for LIPA, and the reason I'm here...
Now, what is LIPA?
Lane Individual Practice Association.
And what do they do?
We're the fully capitated health plan in Lane County. We manage the Oregon Health Plan.
And you've been involved in both of these programs?
Yes, sir.
How?
Well, in terms of 100% access, we were one of the convening parties. We had held a meeting with United Way to start addressing the changes in OHP standard, and out of that meeting, the 2004 assessment had come to light. And so we worked with Pacific Source, United Way, LIPA, Senator Wyden's office, and Representative DeFazio's office had worked together to pull together the collaborative.
Okay, so you, so to speak, initiated the collaborative?
It was a joint...
Well, I understand that, but who called a meeting with United Way?
Oh, we had initially called a meeting with United Way to discuss the changes that were occurring with OHP standard and the benefit cuts that were potentially going to happen and how we were going to address as a community.
So then the IPAs have a very important role to play in establishing these collaboratives.
Yes, sir. We're part of the community.
Well, yeah. I mean, you're already doing all that stuff, so... contacting United Way, who has a different realm of interest, you brought them into the process, which then allowed it to proceed. Mm-hmm. What about senior connections?
Chair Morissette and members of the committee, our involvement with senior connections is the fact that we have shared clients that we both care for. And so we're trying to find ways to partner and to provide better services and more efficient services, if at all possible, to our shared clients. And this was a way for us to work together and to hopefully augment each other's work to provide better services.
And do you have participants in Florence, in LIPA?
No, sir, not at this time.
Oh, okay. Well, you better get busy. Well, no, I mean, I think it's a great example of the different organizations that are in the community and then bringing them together and doing these programs. Mm-hmm.
And Chair Morris said, I'd like to also comment that LIPA has been very open to receiving presentations from our staff on services that we provide that they may not be aware of. I've been to their office, and I believe others and my staff have, to educate their staff on the various services that are out there for folks.
Okay, and I am on the board of the nonprofit for Senior Connections, and we have bake sales and collect cans and bottles and have raffles and do all kinds of things. I was afraid that program was going to have major cuts, but I guess it's...
We're the wait and see kind of attitude right now. We're holding on.
And the 501c3 is important then for the fundraising part of it, as a separated from Lane Council of Governments.
Correct, yes. The Senior Connections program really needs about an infusion of $40,000 to $50,000 per year to maintain the current service levels from the funding that we receive.
And that comes from the community?
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, so that's a lot of money. A lot of cans and bottles.
Yeah.
Okay. Other questions? Comments? Okay. Thank you very
much.
Thank you. Okay. Well, you can all go forth and do good and don't screw up, right?
Well, a little piece of optimism today that things are happening, you know, and some communities are making things work.
I think that's wonderful. And that's kind of the purpose of it, just to show that there are things, good things happening. So, okay, with that, we will close the public hearing, and we are adjourned 15 minutes early. Thank you. Thank you very much for being here.